Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugapul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Nunnaka, Kwandamuka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, it's Friday. Blue sky, sunshine. Beautiful day. Beautiful way to finish up the end of the week. Well, it's only the end of the week for some of us. I mean, we can't just sort of take it around. Everybody just shuts shop and goes and puts their feet up for the weekend. Some continue on to work and do different things. But for us here, yeah, it's a weekend coming up. My guest today joins me via telephone. He's a Brisbane-based Murray, Richard Bell, well, a very well-known artist, winner of the 2003 National Telstra Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Art Award and a recipient of Location One International Fellowship in New York. We're going to tell us about that because I think he spent some time over there in New York as a result of that award. But very well known First Nations artist. Richard, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, Tiger. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, no, thanks for giving us your time. It's important to us that we get to speak to people in community and artists like people like yourself, an artist that uses art, I believe, in a provocative way, in some sense, in some cases. How would you describe it? Activism, activism art. For want of a better term. But before we go there, tell us your mob, your country.
Okay, well, I was born out of country in a place called Charleville in southwestern Queensland. My father was Yemen and Garang Garang. My mother was Komore and Yemen. Lived in and around Charleville, you know, for the first few years of my life. You know. And ended up spending some time up in Darwin with my mother and brother. Then lived in Rocky briefly, went back to Charleville, Mitchell, then Derby, where I finished school, and then I headed down south, went fruit picking, and ended up in Sydney. Was going to stay there overnight, ended up staying 10 years. So. And that's where I was politicised. You know, I got there in the early 70s, and it was just pretty interesting times, actually.
It was very interesting times, yeah, yes.
We crossed paths down there quite a few times. So.
I watched you run around with the Redfern All Blacks. It was a regular weekend event for me and the missus and the family to get out and watch the All Blacks games, and you were a regular member of the team there for a number of years.
Yeah. Well, I played with the Blacks for 10 years there.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun, right?
You know, I learned a lot too during that time there.
Yeah. Yes, no, it was good times politically for young fellas. We're both born in 53, so for young fellas like us to be in that environment and learn the politics and things, I think it was a good era, a good period of time there for us.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the Australian people were a lot more generous in those days towards Aboriginal people. I have to say, there's a lot of mean-spiritedness in and around Aboriginal communities now, though.
The mean-spiritedness, yes. And the budget, the way the cuts in the budget to small programs and things, health promotions and health and things like that, when we're the most disadvantaged, you know. The mean-spiritedness certainly comes through, and it's good that you mention it, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like... There's a minister for mining, there's a minister for health, but, you know, like, we have a minister against Aborigines, you know.
But we got a prime minister for Aboriginal people, eh? He reckons?
Yeah, we're a prime minister against Aboriginal people, it seems. it's not the best these days, you know. Like, it's good to see some of the young people starting to stand up and be counted, you know, like in the struggles against the treatment that the government is handing out to our people.
Most certainly. When did you get that interest get the interest and think that, well, art is a way for me, is something I can do and I can progress? The political aspects of things, the activist sort of, for want of a better term, I don't like the word activist, it's people are really politicians, they're people that are working in community for change, you know, and this activist term gets put on us, and I think it's a negative connotation to activist, but
there is that negativity there, but, you know, like I'm sort of buy into it in the art world, you know, like it gives me a point of difference, you know, like when I market myself in the art world, you know, like having that, like I describe myself as an activist who masquerades as an artist. So I do buy into the activist sort of things. If I'm not happy with something, I'll certainly let people know, you know, that I'm not happy. And art, I found, has been the best way of doing that. You know, like I can use different techniques, you know, to get across, you know, different messages and that sort of thing. So,
when did you start with art? When did you get start to dabble?
Late '80s. I just finished working for the Catholic Church in Moree. I was employed to set up an Aboriginal corporation that they could hand over, you know, property to. And after going through that process, I realised that there was never going to be jobs in management for me other than, you know, in the area of welfare. So I decided that I would strike out and do something different. And I joined my younger brother, Marshall, working on the Aboriginal tourist art business. That's how I got my first taste of art, albeit tourist art, and then I gradually moved into fine art after that.
Mm. In 2003, you won the National Telstra Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Art Award. I mean, that was big.
Yeah, it was. That sort of moved me on to the national arena. You know, like moved on up. Spent the 40 grand moving on up. You know, like I hadn't had a bed with legs, you know, kind of for 10 years prior to that. So one of the first things I did was get out and buy a bed, you know, rather than just having a mattress on the floor, so, and things like that, and put all the mod cons, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
it was a pretty remarkable time for me. Just after that, I wrote an essay, which the painting was about. Traditionally, Aboriginal art has a story. Well, the story for this was how people looked at Aboriginal art. And the name of the paper was Bell's Theorem, and then in brackets, Aboriginal art, it's a white thing. I spoke about how the construct that is Aboriginal art has no control of Aboriginal people over it. And there's been a lot of changes since I wrote that essay, since I won that prize, including the resale royalty legislation which the Labor Party brought in.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you your views on that in a little while. You spent some time in New York, Location One, the International Fellowship. You were a recipient. Tell us about that award.
That was a fantastic opportunity for me to go to New York and live for almost a year. I had a show there and made some work there, met lots and lots of people, in the New York art scene. I got to take two of my daughters over there and spend some time with them in one of the great cities of the world. It was fantastic. That helped me move on up, to another level as well. It got me a tour of some university museums in America. So I went to Boston, Lexington, Denver, and Bloomington, Indiana. So you got quite a bit of exposure there. Got a publication out of it, and that sort of thing. So
it's a good interest there. I mean, for an artist like yourself, that whose artwork can be provocative and controversial and stuff. I mean, it's not the traditional dot art and stuff like this. You've got a message there. You've got some strong stuff happening.
The approach that I take to it is very un-Aboriginal too. You know, to have an opinion and espouse it loudly is very un-Aboriginal.
To be so confronting, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Some people find it confronting. I just consider it to be a matter of fact. I'm just pointing out the obvious.
It's your experience. It's what you and our mob generally experience.
Well, we're both 60 now, mate. Mm. We've been around the block more than a few times, we've learnt quite a bit along the way. Well, I hope to think that we have,
and learned a bit on the block too down there.
Definitely did. Yeah, I learned a hell of a lot there.
That's for sure.
Learned a lot of about the Aboriginal history. Learned a lot about the process of self-determination. Versus assimilation, I've got to say that I'm still an anti-assimilationist. I'm a pro-self-determinationist, I would describe myself as.
Yeah. Yes, now it's assimilation eventually results in genocide, doesn't it, really?
Absolutely. Well, that's what assimilation, that's a net result of assimilation, and requires us to give up our culture. Our way of life, our beliefs, to adopt the new system. So I'm definitely against it. Yeah. I'll always be against it. Yeah. And bugger all the other people.
Along the way, you were involved with a group of a collective of artists that came to be known as Proper Now. Where the name? Tell us about that and the name Proper Now.
We set it up in 2004. That was me, Jennifer Hurd, and Vernon Arkey. And we just were discussing, our practices and how difficult we found it. We're not seen as being authentic Aboriginal artists. Basically, you have to be from the Northern Territory or some remote community somewhere to be a real blackfella. So
like Cap York, Arakoon, somewhere like that.
And we wanted to assert our Aboriginality, and we thought that the best way of doing that was to set up an arts collective, and we wanted to do things blackfella way, proper way. And we wanted to do it now, so we just combined those two words, proper and now. So Proper Now came our name.
You spent some time in the building I'm sitting at the moment before we actually acquired it.
Yes, we were there for about 3 years. I think the property developer was Paul, one of my art collectors, so I've asked him if he had any properties available, that I could use as an art studio, and And he offered me the garage part of this massive big building. You know, there's like 1,800 square metres available there. And he offered me about 200 or so. And I had a look at the other stuff, and I just put it on him and said, look, I've got a friend, a heap of friends in this artist group that we've got. We can fill this place out. And, you know, like, he said, yeah, sure. So, you know, we came to an arrangement, you know, where we gave paintings and that for it in exchange for getting use of that space, which served us really well for those 3 years. So.
One of the issues, or one of the ways it served you well, was I think it was Vernon R. Key, and maybe yourself, but just were doing, there were some massive pieces of canvas that just needed big space. I mean, where would you, I mean, that's one of the challenges with at least one of your artists in the group.
Yeah, well, most of us do big works, you know, at different times, you know, and we had, there was an enormous garage there, so, you know, like, the guys could make really big sculptures too if they wanted to. So it was just the most wonderful studio space for us that we've ever had. And if there's any property developers out there listening, you know, and you've got some nice space, you know, like, that's empty at the moment, you know, think about your local artists and see if you can do a deal with them.
Support.
Get some great art in your house and that sort of thing. And,
for sure.
In exchange.
Yeah. Have you seen that many changes? I mean, well, before we go to that particular question, the appropriation of our art. There's been some legal blues along the way. Some have been won to do with the questioning of the authenticity of our art. A lot of it dot art. Some of it being copied by people that aren't even from this country. Not even our mob. From how do you feel about that? I mean, has that been sort of curtailed somewhat? Is it still happening? What's the situation?
According to, you know, to contemporary Western art, you know, like, appropriation is a legitimate practice. You know, but you know, there's. Now, that's being challenged. That's been challenged by Aboriginal people here, you know, for many years. There's many people from around the world, you know, like, who also challenge the idea that appropriation is okay, appropriation of other people's culture is okay. You know, I know that most Aboriginal people that I talk to don't think it's okay. You know, so yeah, we're still having that discussion. Around the country, you know, with different artists. You know, most of the Australian artists, you know, like, accept that Aboriginal art is for Aboriginal people to use. You know? Now, us East Coast blacks, you know, like, we're basically not allowed to make Aboriginal art, you know, like, in the same way that the people from the remote areas are. So, you know, why do they let white people do it? You know, if they don't let other black fellas do it.
So are there some conflicting views about the way East Coast blacks or urban contemporary, whatever the term?
Whatever, yeah.
Is there some conflicting views or some pressure put on artists like yourself from the artists in a more remote communities or doing what they might call traditional art? Is there such a thing as traditional art?
The black fellows that I've had discussions with, you know, they've always been really generous, you know, and, you know, like, they've not said that we can't use dots and lines and that sort of thing. The big thing that they're on about is stories, you know, like, they don't want us using their stories and that sort of thing. And there's some designs that, you know, that are actually owned by people. So, you know, weren't allowed to use those, according to blackfellas law. So there's not a lot of conflict there. No, I don't think with blackfellas, but there's a few white fellas who are still doing it. But we've been in discussions with those people for quite some time, and sometimes successful and sometimes not. And it's not really our job, to police these things. The people who own the designs and that that are being appropriated, it's really their job. I've recently spoken out about a particular artist who had a work in Adelaide.
Was an Archibald Prize winner.
Yes. About her appropriation of Aboriginal art and how she uses it as filler in her works. But I spoke out after 8 years. I just waited for other people to say something.
Just to question it.
Yeah, just to question. What is this? What does it mean?
How'd you feel about the answer, the response? I mean, one could say, well, you should feel okay. I mean, the old saying, imitation is the best form of... What's that word? Is the best...
Flattery.
Flattery or something like that. They're copying.
The sincerest form of flattery, yeah. I've got sort of different views on these things, but for me, there's all these unresolved issues, between... Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people in this country. This is our country. At least respect our culture. Don't just go and ripping it from us. This is all we've got left. They've taken everything else.
Yes, have some respect for our views.
Yeah, and, some respect, some decency.
Yes, that's right. Yes, common decency comes into play for sure.
Yeah, for sure. There's so much of it still going on. And to me, I think the curators and the gallery directors, they need to have a look at themselves. And they should be severely criticised, for putting these people in shows, and awarding them prizes. Bugger them, this is appalling, the way that Aboriginal people have been treated over this issue.
The resale, royalty resale scheme. What are your thoughts on that? Are there examples of that working internationally? And is it something that needs more work on in this country? Is it something that's valued by artists, be they...
It could work, some circumstances. France has a resale royalty scheme, but if the French want to sell anything, they just, to avoid the resale royalty, they just sell it in London.
All right. Interesting.
Yeah, if it becomes a huge problem, I'm probably thinking that they'll have sales in New Zealand or Singapore, where they don't have a resale royalty thing. So if it becomes that important to them.
There's ways around it. There's loopholes that they can...
There's ways around it. The resale royalty scheme was brought in essentially to... stop people, carpetbaggers, from going into Aboriginal communities. I don't think it'll work in that. They're still doing that. I think the much better approach would be to encourage the young kids in the communities to start looking after their uncles and aunties. You know, like they've all got the modern technology. They've got access to mobile phones and that sort of thing. They can be taught how to document the works and that, and how to email these images and that around the country. You know, they'd be able to order supplies, all these sorts of things. That are being provided by the art centres. You know, there's lots of government funding going directly to white people, you know, which would be better off going to the black people in those communities.
Is there still very much that sort of gap there where First Nations mob are there just purely to create the art, and then you've got the administration, the management, the people that run the exhibitions and that? Is that largely non mainstream mob?
Yes, it is. That was part of the premises behind Bell Serum, where I wrote about the Aboriginal arts world in this country. It was, nothing much has changed in that regard.
And that's back in 2003 you wrote that, wasn't it? Or back in that early 2000s?
Oh, 2002 I wrote it.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And made the painting the following year to go with it.
Mm. What's changed in that 10 or 12 years since then? Has there been any change, any improvement? Some of our mob stepping up as the what do you call them, fellas that put on them artworks? And the...
I don't know that much has changed. They've certainly changed the marketing. Like one of the things I pointed out was the anthropological approach to marketing Aboriginal art, or more the ethnographic approach to marketing Aboriginal art, where they put the artist's name and then their language group and where they're from, and then there's a story that goes with it. Whereas with the white people, with everybody else in art, you know, all they put is the name, you know, like, and their date of birth, and if they're dead, the year they died, sort of thing. So it's not it's a very different approach, and that sort of denigrated the art in a lot of ways, and in particular, it made them ethnographic. So put off to the side of other art museums around the world.
Talking about ethnographics and things, the things have changed somewhat with modern technology, where it's not just all canvas and oils and things.
No,
watercolors.
It's very exciting. You know, I myself have moved into video. Which is a really exciting area of art making, and certainly it's much more collaborative than with painting. Painting is a very personal thing, and often people just do it alone. Whereas filmmaking, you basically have to collaborate with other people, so it's, I really enjoy that process. There's now 3D printers where you can make almost anything.
Yeah.
Just amazing technology.
So where do you see yourself going from here on in, delving into more film, video stuff? What do you see? What do you see out there for yourself? That you need to do or want to do?
I definitely want to do more film. Moving pictures, it's almost irresistible, really, for me. I'll always paint, though. That's when you find something that you're good at and that you can get paid for. You know, it's pretty hard to walk away from that kind of thing. And they, the paintings actually subsidise my filmmaking. I'm self-taught. I'm still learning. I haven't mastered it yet. I'm hopeful that soon I'll be able to make money from my filmmaking as well.
Richard, before I go into and ask you about what are you working on, let's look at what you've just recently done, the Embassy exhibition that's just only recently finished up over in Perth at the art festival over there. The Embassy, yeah, of course, is the 72 Embassy, I take it. Tell us about it. How did that come to be, and what did you create that was presented there in Perth?
I've created a space for discussion. You know, in today's world, you know, like it's very difficult. You know, with the mainstream media, the way the ownership is concentrated, you know, we're getting this one message. So I wanted to create a space away from that where we could talk about issues that aren't being discussed in other areas. So I wanted to use the idea of an embassy, you know, which is where people actually do go to have discussions that they can't have elsewhere. And looking at the Aboriginal tent embassy, from 1972, you know, it was like a piece of performance art, you know, like what happened there, the way that whole thing unfolded. So, and those guys were incredibly brave and creative. So I wanted to pay homage to those guys, so like a couple of them who ended up being friends of mine. So they're pretty good friends. So
that exhibition, did you do paintings? What did you do? How did you create this exhibition? What is it? Describe it to me.
Oh, okay. Well, there were some paintings. There were six paintings, and they were all quite big. The biggest one was a collaboration that I did with African-American artist called Emery Douglas, who was the Minister for Culture in the Black Panther Party in the 60s and 70s. He did all the illustration and that sort of thing. Created a piece which we were originally going to paint onto a wall, but the gallery put up this false wall, and the wall is about 14 metres long and 3 metres high, and a bit of the painting extends onto the wall, so it's more than 15 metres long and 3 metres high. Then there was 5 other paintings, and they covered 3 sides of this gallery. And then I placed this really good sized tent with some of the original signs, you know, copies of the original signs from the tent embassy and that sort of thing. Okay, the space where we could have discussions. But in, you know, while those discussions weren't taking place, I put some videos that I put together. There's three part trilogy, you know, that are called Imagining Victory. So I'm along with Gary Foley, Imagined Victory, you know, because nothing has ever happened without it being imagined first. So, you know, like, I was thinking, well, what we really need to do is to imagine victory. You know, what will victory look like for Blackfellas in this country? You know, like, what will What will the political situation look like? You know, what will the business situation look like? What will this land ownership question? What will all that look like? So things like that.
What do you see when you say imagine victory? What do you see?
Well, for me, victory is us getting control of this country again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not for me to negotiate how that happens. You know, like that's what I see as victory.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of other people don't, but that's my imagination of victory.
Yes. Yeah. In working with people like Emery. And spending some time in New York and places like that, what does that do for your personal development and growth as an individual, but as an artist particularly? Are there particular influences that you come back with or ideas?
I think one of the things that I came back from New York with is probably a stronger work ethic. To work harder. Well, what I noticed about Americans more than anything was how they respect money. Both when they're spending it, but also in earning it. You know, like if you bought something from somebody, they were so appreciative of you giving them money. It was really weird. The traders here, they want to get as much out of you as they can, whereas they tended to have this idea of giving a fair price, which I found really weird. You know, this is the capital of capitalism in the whole world. So how that came out. The other thing that I looked at was how ordinary we all are, I noticed how little you had to do to stand out from the ordinary. I saw a program on anabolic steroids and how much they improve people, in sport. And they were saying that the maximum improvement is 8%. And yet these guys look absolutely unbeatable, having, between, I imagine 2 and 8% improvement, So that made me start thinking, well, damn, I only have to improve myself by, 2, 3, 4, 5%, and I'm... my practice is going to get so much better, and this also applies to sport. People train hard. They'll become better. And the improvement is only very very small percentage wise, but those percentages make a huge difference in life. That's what I sort of noticed in my observations of people over there, through discussions and that with people.
What are you working on now? What is yet to be done for Richard Bell as an artist? You've said that you would like to, you're certainly going to polish up your skills with film and video and stuff like that, but what are you working on now and what's yet to be done?
I'm just changing direction a bit, with my painting. I've used one particular style, one particular approach for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm just moving away from that now with my painting.
In the way of, a lot of your artwork is very colourful. Beautiful colours out there. They're just bright and splashed around. You talking about changing in that or what? Well, what do you mean when you say you're changing?
No, I'm not going to go away from colour, but in just a slightly different approach to what I was doing before. There'll still be lots of colour. I just love colour. But I've also got some black and white stuff happening at the moment with the paintings. As far as film goes, I'm working on this film about this evil art dealer who is actually ruining the art world at the moment. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, all right. One thing that comes to mind, I saw an image of it you'd paint, I think that was black and white too, was the 68 Olympic Games in Mexico, where two African-Americans had a protest, and there was an Australian there that was in support of them. Tell us, what was it about that struck you and thought, you know, you need to document that?
Oh, well, I just remembered it, and working with Emery, we got talking about it, and just that image, and it's one of the most recognisable images in human history. So to do it, you know, everybody kind of recognises it now. You know, they've actually seen this image in some form, you know, like during their lifetime. So
that image was Jesse Owens, was it? Was it Jesse Owens? What was his name?
No. It was
two African Americans.
Two guys, you know, two African American guys called Tommy Smith and John Carlos. And there was lots of protests going on in 1968. There was talk of a boycott by the black athletes then, but nobody wanted to do that. So they left it up to the individuals to make the protest, and these two guys, they wanted to make a protest on the victory dais, they wouldn't do that without first asking the permission of the other athlete on that dais with them, and he just happened to be an Australian, and he agreed with them, and he actually supported them by wearing a badge, you know, supporting the United Nations Project for Human Rights. And they also did a couple of other very symbolic things that day. When they walked towards the platform, they took their shoes off, and that was to protest against poverty in the United States. And they also wore these beads, which were a protest against the lynchings in the United States as well. So they didn't disrespect the flag. What they did was they raised their fists in defiance of the symbolism of the American flag, and they bowed their heads in deference to it. That's what they said. So there was a whole lot of symbolism involved in that whole process, and that young white man on that historic moment with them, he was just happened to be Australian, you know, like, and he made that stand, you know, just a year after the referendum giving the Commonwealth rights to make laws for Aboriginal people, and well, it was still 4 years before the White Australia policy would stop being official government policy of this country. So he was very brave in taking that stand, but he was punished for it later in life.
Really? What was his name?
Peter Norman.
Right.
Peter Norman. He was from Melbourne. He actually died in 2006. And Tommy Smith and John Carlos were pallbearers. They'd become friends. They became lifelong friends after that. That event in Mexico City, they would visit each other every 2 years, you know, every 4 years. Peter Norman would go to America to visit them. So, and they're very famous in America. And Peter Norman is much more famous in America than he is here in this country. And I wanted to sort of change that, and hope that people you know, learn this guy's name and learn about this story. It's a wonderful story, you know, of the human struggle.
For sure. You know, what was his event that he was? Was he bronze, silver, a medal?
Well, he was a silver medalist. Mm. These two, the two Americans had been swapping the world record, you know, like for 200 metres, you know, for the previous 12 months or so. You know, and Peter Norman came from basically nowhere. You know, Smith and Carlos had been training at altitude. You know, the Mexico City Games were held at altitude, and but that was a huge disadvantage, you know, for someone like Peter Norman, who was coming from training at sea level. So, you know, for him to actually get where he did that day was an amazing feat.
All right.
And yeah, and who knows? You know, like if another athlete had run a place in that race, they may not have allowed them people to make their protest. So, you know, it's a pretty historic event, you know, for everybody involved in that. So,
most certainly. In winding up this yarn, what would you say to people that? No, they don't see themselves as ours. A lot of our mob, you find, well, not a lot, but some of our mob that have gone in and done some time in correction centres have developed a love of and a real talent for some beautiful, fine art. What would you say to people that they don't necessarily have to go to jail to do that, but if they do get the inclination and they do think, you know, they'd like to try something out, what do you say to our mob?
Read lots. Talk to lots of people, and make lots of paintings or videos or whatever it is. Whatever it is, if you do lots of it, you'll definitely get better at it. Anyway, you know, that's my little thing for everybody now is just to practice as much as you can.
Right.
That's it.
All right, Richard, anything else you want to add before winding up?
I'd just like to say g'day to all my friends and family, and hope this big mob of you has been listening today and take it easy on me next time you see me.
All right. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us today. It's been a really good yarn, and it's good to hear your story.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's been great.
You take it easy and good luck with the film work. Yeah, we need it. Good on you. Right, on, brother. Thank you. Bye now. Richard Bell, very well-known First Nations artist.